Okay. Further, Rev Lopiansky needs no introduction to this yeshiva. His Torah is heard in this yeshiva constantly through many of us who say over many of his pieces of Torah, his inimitable metaphors, etc. So, and those of you who were here last year got to enjoy Rabbi Lopiansky last year. Okay, I get to moderate. Okay. So I hand it over the mantle. So
first, let me just apologize for being a bit late, but I think that Yitzhahara had all the Kaz Yishayim lined up between Rav Sheffer was staying till here. I think there was a massive car park, so.
No problem.
Yeah.
Okay, we decided to start really simple and really sort of simple, superficial. So the Christians divide up God into three, which we don't like. And yeah. Recently, this person writes, I have realized that we divide God up into 10 within the spheros and billions within the Tzelem Elohim, etc. There seem to be many different compartments and attributes to God, which all might add and extend to infinity, but are still divided up. Seems like almost like by the way the Christians do. By us, is this a division of God, and by them it's not? By us it's not, and by them it is? How do we reconcile these answers? What is oneness? What does Echad really mean?
So, the question actually almost with this formulation was posed to Ramban in his vikuach, in his argument with a former convert, someone converted to Christianity. It also was formulated in an attack on the Kabbalistic, on the Mekubalim. It was in a Chubas Rivash. He was 14th century Spanish Gadol, who someone asked him, are the Mekubalim not dividing it in, do they not have 10 gods? Are they not the believer in some sort of 10 figure? So the Ramban posed this, asked back, tell me, that Trinity, how can you believe in a Trinity? And he said, well, you also believe, you say God's ability, God's this, God's that. So the Ramban replied to him, can the Trinity ever disagree or not? In other words, could there be some sort of vote where it's 2-1? If the answer is yes, then these are three separate entities. If the answer is no, it's like saying me, myself, and I, then I'm saying three words that mean the same thing. So the real question is there a point of oneness and all of these are simply expressions of it? So let's take an example. I have two people teaching. I have a person who's teaching, but he really hasn't gotten his act together. And sometimes he comes into the classroom and he's upset and surly and angry. Sometimes he comes in, he's very upbeat and optimistic. So I say to myself, this person has really two parts of himself, three parts of himself, different moods. And you hope that you get the person who is the good mood as a person as the bad mood. Compare that to a teacher, like the type they have in the Mechon Yaakov, of course,
only
who are in perfect control of themselves, and they come in with that's perfect equanimity. And now the question is, what tactic shall I use with my students today? Shall I be challenging? Shall I be embracing, encouraging, disparaging? What's the best tool? And he will also use different approaches, but I recognize there's one control that's always the same. That control is, how do I get them best to do X, Y, or Z? And then these are different tools at my disposal. The difference between those two examples is infinite. One is two separate, and the difference is the personality A has regrets about personality B, and vice versa. I'm so upset that I lost myself yesterday, and so on and so forth. Whereas the person who's in perfect control, everything comes from one place, and it's just a question of tactic. So a king will have a minister of defense, of war, whatever you want to call it, and he will be very kind of mean and tough and always growling and saying, we're going to destroy, we're going to this and that and the other thing. He has a minister of foreign affairs who's sweet, nice, and wonderful. And we recognize if the king is a real full authority or prime minister, whatever setup you have, then it's simply different ways of expressing or attaining a certain goal. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu is one. And therefore, even though the experiences we go through in the world are extraordinarily manifold, it's all coming from one place. So I always have to look and take the points on the perimeter of the circle and circumference of the circle and ask myself, it's always pointed to the same point in the middle. There's a famous expression of that in the Gemara. The Gemara says that in the future, in other words, in the day of the end of time, so to speak, the righteous will form a circle around God and they'll all be pointing and saying, Hinei ze Elokeinu, this is our God. So what that's expressing is you have the same God, exactly the same God, pointed out by people standing at polar opposites or at sides of the same circle. So the understanding of Kadosh Baruch Hu is one, and the whole study of Kabbalah, which introduced the idea of pens and spheres and many spheres and so on, was to try to understand how these pieces interact if it's one item. So that's our understanding. I don't speak for Christians. You'll have to bring in a pastor to help you with that, or a priest. I don't know what they believe in. But the litmus test is, if there's no such thing as them disagreeing, then what are we talking about? Then we're playing with words. If there is a possibility of a disagreement, then it's two entities. And no amount of sleight of hand, three that's one and one that's three, is going to get you anywhere. You don't know what you're talking about, and I don't know what you're talking about. So if we know what we're talking about, we have to be able to define it. Does it come down to one point or not? I want to bring something, a parallel point into this, which I find very fascinating. One of the arguments of evolutionists to the lack of a creator is that all the DNA in the world is almost exactly alike. It's embarrassing how much DNA we share with cockroaches. Very, very little difference. And all living things consist of very, very same DNA, and so on. Well, we see it the exact opposite. It's almost as if we're being taught that no matter how much incredible variety of life there is, but take a look, it's all built in the same blocks. It's almost all the same. To us, the root being certain echad, and in life it expressed itself, all living beings are extraordinarily alike, and that's exactly how God should have made it. Had it been random developments, then we would expect a lot more diversity. It's only because HaKadosh Baruch Hu was showing that from a few simple acids, I can construct such an incredible variety of life and living things.
Number two, if my job is to seek truth, so why should I stop with Judaism? Why am I not intellectually obligated to check out the other religions who also believe they hold the truth?
So there's a concept, she'elas chacham, a wise man's question. In other words, questions and a quest are a tool. And a person needs to ask himself when and where and how will I use a tool for it to be helpful. So, for instance, someone will ask me, why do you live in Silver Spring? And I'll tell him it's a very nice place to live. He'll tell me, why didn't you check out all the other places? So my answer is, that would mean I would be traveling, I'd be the most frequent flyer in existence. I'd have to check every city in the world every town in the world, that's an impossible task. So the there are two ways in which I would change. One is if I happen to be on a visit to somebody somewhere else, and I really say, wow, this is so much nicer, or at least I hear, I have somebody who's a visitor who comes and says, you know, it's not bad here, but it's incredibly nicer somewhere else. Or I really don't like it here, and I say to myself, there's got to be places that are nice, more comfortable. That's the only wise type of quest, or else the person will end up, it's like trying careers. How do I know what career I want? Well, I could start by listing 50 different careers and try each one for a year. You know, I know what the tuition is going to look like, but it's, I mean, that is not a chachma. There are so many religions in the world that it would be impossible. If a person wants to try just Christianity, well, Catholics and Protestants sincerely believe each other one is ending up in hell. So you've got to try Catholics, you've got to try Protestants. Catholics have a very, very serious issue with Orthodox Church and the Catholic, the East and the West. And Baruch Hashem, the Eastern Church has now been splitting more and more. It's got the sound of politics in Ukraine and in Russia and so on and so forth. Protestant denominations range from Unitarian to Episcopalian to Southern Baptists to evangelicals of all types and sorts. Now, to really understand Islam, the Muslims say that the only way you can understand the Quran is in Arabic. And I believe them. I just like Lahavla for those. I don't think anyone who reads Torah only in English will understand it. And then we've got to move on to Buddhism. And again, we've got to get the language, we've got the feeling. Buddhism has two major splits and many smaller ones. We've got Hinduism. So if I'm to ask myself this quest for truth, unless I want to write like the magnum opus on a quest for truth at the end of my life, having never lived more than 6 months in one place, that's going to be anywhere. So I am Jewish. I start where I start. We've met Christians many, we've interacted with them, we've read about it, we've seen some stuff, we have some tangential interaction with that, but I need to start where I am. If I meet a Buddhist who really, really looks to me like his life is a life that has what to offer, then I would honestly need to look into that. If I'm very unhappy with Judaism, I feel Judaism just not giving me spiritual, it's not clicking, then honesty would require moving on. But if it keeps reinforcing itself, the Judaism that I started with is good and reinforces itself and offers a lot, and I haven't met people that I think are the life I would like to live, even though I can think well of them, but I don't think, I can't say they have the truth in any sense, that nothing about it strikes as such, then wisdom says I need to stick where I am and build deeper roots and understand more of it.
What's with the rest of the Jews? What's with the 80% or 90% who don't keep Shabbos? What's the purpose of their creation? And if it's to become Torah observant and the alternative is negative, why would a good thing be creating a system in which most people will fall down and fail? Or is this not necessarily a failure?
So it's interesting. That question was asked by the Akedah. The Akedah was one of the last of the early commentaries. The Akedah lived in the 1400s, kind of up to, he lives in Spain, up until the Spanish expulsion. His magnum opus is called Akedas Yitzchak. The reason why you probably never heard of it is because it's five thick volumes, extremely long pieces. Until very recently, they were unpunctuated, basically, for like dozens of pages. He asks many, many questions, and then he gives a certain concept, and then he explains back in all the psukim, this pshat, and so on. The print was also like a photocopy of a photocopy of a photocopy. It was horrible. I don't know if you get a melos, a schara, a melos, like the reward for working hard on it. It really was. But it was considered one of the great works. Baruch Hashem, in the last 5 years, it's been reprinted by two different people. They've made a great effort to make it more manageable. I got into it. I mean, I've heard of it. I knew of it. But I, for Shabbos in the morning, I used to take different early commentaries. I took on the Akkad. I went through it. I took out the pieces that I felt speak about a major theme. I tried to take out the pieces that go off to tangential issues, punctuated it, paragraphed it, and made, side notes, sidebars, and so on and so forth. He asks, if you take a look, I think it's in Hazinu, if you take a look at Hazinu, which is a description of the history of the Jewish people, one word would seem to describe it. Failure. I mean, if you read Tanakh, if you learn Tanakh, a Chumash, then basically it is the story of humanity messing up. That is the way he asks the question. And he says one or two things. Either Hashem didn't realize how badly we'd mess up, or Hashem doesn't care. Either one, or it didn't work out, even though he planned it differently. None of those answers fit the description of Hashem the way we understand it. A perfect being created a world. He didn't know that this world would mess up. He wanted it to mess up. That's creating something that's a mess. What exactly? How do you understand it? That's his question he poses. He answers. And I'm rephrasing my words. I think the meaning is his, but I like to rephrase my words. Imagine somebody's road to adulthood is full of a lot of mishaps. And he's finally got his act together. He learned from different circumstances. What's bad about this? What's good about this? Why is this required of him? Like many teenagers who have difficult teenage, teenage years. And when they become an adult, for a lot of them, the messing up was a process of adulthood. They understand, just like a child, when he puts his finger in something hot and it's painful, he realizes to stay away from things that are hot. A teenager realizes that if you drink yourself crazy, you end up doing things that you really regret and paying for them. If you don't take studying seriously, you end up outside and so on. And slowly, you begin to form a very strong sense of right and wrong, responsibility, etc. The world as a big entity, Klal Yisrael, Klal Yisrael has tried many things. For instance, in the 1700s, when emancipation in different forms opened up, the headlong rush was to assimilate out. We learned very, very, very strongly that it doesn't work. We're never accepted, we're pushed back. When we learned Germany, we were more German than the Germans. There was somebody famous who committed suicide. He lived in Hamburg. I forgot his name, I just read about him. A great figure, a German Jew, who was being sent off to some camp. I don't remember, but he committed suicide because for him not to live in Hamburg was unthinkable. We were more German than the Germans. That infatuation was taken out of us. And no matter where we are, today, thank God, America is a wonderful country to live, but everybody says, one second, remember Germany. Germany was a more wonderful place to live. Remember, you're not accepted. We learned the hard way. We were infatuated with Christianity. And in Spain, before the Inquisition, tens of thousands of Jews converted out, mostly for reasons of convenience. It was easier to get ahead and so on and so forth. It also was kind of the church of choice, kind of Catholicism was the dominant religion. And then we learned very, very strongly about the religion of love, and nobody has that illusion anymore, and so on. Many things, we ran after many things, and then we realize, this is not it. And in a big picture, Klal Yisrael is being formed. It's HaKadosh Baruch Hu, it's just like a teenager. Sometimes you have the rare teenager just does the right thing and so on and so forth. Most of the time, a smart person lets a person take the consequence of the actions and comes back again. If you take a look at the Tochacha, the things that the Tochacha is the part of the Torah that tells us the difficult things that will befall us if we sin, and there are two major portions like that in the Torah, and most of it is to get us to realize what we've done wrong, where we've been wrong, and therefore there's a story. The Kloisenberger Rebbe was a Hasidic rabbi in Romania, Hungary. I don't know, those days countries were irrelevant. But he was in that area. He was a young man. His family of 11 children and wife were killed in the war. And he went through hell in the concentration camps, survived to become a great Hasidic leader in New York. And in Netanya, he has Kiryat Sanz. He was a huge Talmud Chacham. And an extraordinary person, just in terms of just larger than life. He had his schedule and everything about him was just beyond. I was zochet to him. My father was with him together in the DP camps, and my father took me once or twice to him as a young boy, and I went to him in Netanya. I heard him speak a few times. He was a very, very big person. He died in 1994. So he's told over that in the concentration camp, he noticed somebody laying on the I don't know what to call it. They slept on like these huge shelves, these wooden shelves where they had dozens of just piled up people. That was the bed, and there was somebody, a new person there. This person looked something about him was very different than anybody else, and he asked him who he is. And he told him that he is a person who is he was an assimilated Jew, had married somebody not Jewish. His children were obviously not Jewish. He was somebody very high in the finance minister. I think he had been like the equivalent of the governor general of the Hungarian bank, of a national bank. And, you know, when the time came, they dumped him. And he was very upset and angry. He had saved Hungary from hyperinflation in after World War I, and he had done a lot. And the Rebbe said to him, he starts schmoozing him, he says, tell me something. The government didn't do anything to help you? He said, no. He said, they don't feel at all any gratitude to you? They don't recognize it? And he kept pushing and pushing. And this person says to him, why are you pushing so hard? It's painful for me. And then the next night, he says, and what about your wife and children? Did you mistreat her? Did you mistreat them? Why are they so distant? Why aren't they doing anything for you? And he kept pushing and pushing. And this person was very upset. And he told the Rebbe, why are you stepping on my wounds? Finally, the third night, the Rebbe kept pursuing. And this person broke down and sobbed and said, I've been living in an illusion all my life. And that was the last night he was there. He was never there again. You know, they took him out of the hill. And the Rebbe said he died of Baal Teshuva. That was the way he described it. So we learned something. Very hard, but slowly. So when we look at big sweeping events, Klal Yisrael has... Let's give another example that's very current. When Israel was founded, it wasn't founded just as a state. Zionism was founded as a new national identity. Judaism is not defined by these Sfarim. It's defined by a country, farming, defending itself, and so on. And that's enough. It's just like if you ask a Frenchman what makes him French, it has nothing to do with religion. Catholicism happens to be the religion of France, but it has to do about the language, the culture, the place, the geographic location. And that's what it was predicated on. And a lot of things were assumed, if we have our own country, no more Jewish stereotypes. We're not these people who live in other people's country or for other people. We live in our own country. we're not peddlers and wanderers. We're farmers, really good farmers. We live off the hard labor in the land and so on and so forth. We won't have this wanderlust, this desire to be all over the place. We'll have our own settled consciousness. That was the hypothesis. It's been somewhat disproven. We're as hated as ever. It's now, instead of remedying anti-Semitism, it's the cause of anti-Semitism. I don't think it's the only cause of anti-Semitism, but it's certainly used as a club, this type of club, anti-Semitism. Jews don't like farming the land. They hire Arabs to farm the land, and they would rather market it. And the Wanderlust, now that we have our own airline, there's not a hole in the world you won't find an Israeli. Every time a plane crashes in the most distant place in a flight between Fiji Islands and Malaysia, there'll be a report whether any Israelis on the flight or not. I always find it amusing. Misrad HaChutz said that, to the best of the knowledge, there's no Israeli there. Why would there be? And many times there is an Israeli there. Nothing has changed. And more than that, if you ask an Israeli, there's no identity. He's Israeli, that's a nationality, it's a country, he serves. But it has not substituted Judaism. And especially when Israelis make Yerida, they live in Chutz Laretz, they're lost, they're bewildered. They don't have a personal identity, and they look for it. And many people become Baal Teshuva in America because this is the first time they have to grapple with the sense of, who am I, what am I? So, I don't know. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the all of Klai Yisrael is Klai Yisrael. I don't like going into Gilgal and all that stuff. I just say, in the sweeping scope of history, HaKadosh Baruch Hu allows us to try many things. We flounder, we fall, and we learn, and we regroup. And that's all we could see. If somebody wants to see one of the great miracles, I'm never tired of saying this. In 1945, any intelligent and rational analyst, if you'd ask him, what is the chance that there will be Torah Judaism again, observant Judaism? What is the chance of Jewish people surviving? The answer would be 0 point something or other on both of them. 1945, East European Jewry was gone. 6 million Jews, gone. Israel was struggling with under a million people maybe, and it was not a country, it was busy with fights and wars and nothing doing. Certainly observance was at a low. America was rapidly assimilating outwards. Orthodox synagogues were kind of conservative. Children of conservative people were marrying out, and that was the end of it. So standing in 1945, nothing logical would have predicted where we are today. In my days, that the idea that people who were non-observant would come and spend time and learn about Torah and Yiddishkeit was unthinkable. Why? I'm not sure. But that's the way it was. The question was holding on desperately to what you had. So the mega hashgacha on Klal Yisrael, I believe it will encompass everybody. How and what and why, I don't know. But this has been the history of Klal Yisrael. We've lost 10 tribes out of 12. We've lost 80% of the tribe. And yet somehow it's come back again in some ways, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, only He knows.
This is pulling together three different questions. What's our role in interacting with those non-religious Jews and giving a better appreciation of Judaism? What about interested non-Jews? Two questions pulled together. Oh, I guess the third one is what about like modern Orthodox or disaffected Jews or non-inspired Jews who have some kind of halacha? What's our role, basically, as Baal Teshuva?
So, first of all, I think the role, being a role model, in the sense of here you are, somebody who is inspired, who chose to do this, who finds meaning in it, who lives up to standards and is genuine and honest. It is one of the greatest influences on other people, whether they admit it or not. Very few times when people in any way became observant because of the arguments, the talks, anything like it. Even question and answer sessions don't always do it. It's people that you meet that you say to yourself, you know, there's something about this way of life. There's something about these people that this is where I would like to be part of. It's people influence people by their own self. And if a person is genuine about what he does, if a person is warm towards other people, then so certainly, you know, most of you, probably everybody, most of your families are not observant, not even, or maybe somewhat traditional. If they see you happy where you are, and you can expect them sometimes to make remarks that are less than kind, and maybe to give you trouble. If you handle it gracefully, it's two advantages. Let's play it out a little bit. If somebody sees you with, let's say, a kippah on your head or tzitzis, and says, "What is this crazy stupid thing that you've," and you lash back and say, "Well, your life is meaningless. Your life is worthless," or some other gem of that nature. Then there are two things. You've expressed two things. First of all, nobody likes to be considered devoid of values and meaning, etc. Said not to be told. Two, it shows that you're not secure in where you are. A reflex of jumping back is the biggest sign of insecurity. If you come back with a joke, taking a side, saying something, waiting to see what I'm wearing next month, whatever shtick is, then the person first of all feels that you're comfortable with yourself. He feels that you're not threatening them, and you know he himself, and you don't have to. You can tell a person, "I found meaning in this. I found my life didn't have meaning." That other person, if you say that, the other person might start thinking about his own life. If you tell him your life has no meaning to it, I assure you nobody ever admitted to that. So the best bet is to be who you are, comfortable with yourself, I mean, proud of yourself, and interacting pleasantly with other people.
We've heard on numerous occasions that one of the places where Balei Tshuva go wrong is by not properly integrating into the FFB world, the firm world. What is the proper way to integrate without becoming a conformist?
That's almost like a tautology, maybe, or I don't want to go oxymoron tautology. I think the first thing is to understand that the Torah created also a certain culture. A culture means the things that are not written that you have to do or can't do, but are a normal outgrowth of it, sometimes direct, sometimes positive, sometimes just an outgrowth, sometimes not even positive. But there's a culture to religious societies as well. There's Hasidim have a certain culture to them, Yeshivish people have a certain culture, Kanoim have a certain culture to them, modern Orthodox have a certain culture.
Kanoim
means zealots, like the firebrands. There is something about it, and a person needs to understand two things. First of all, if you're going to fit into a society, whichever society you end up fitting into, you need to ask yourself, not only I'm observant Jew and they're observant Jew, so it's compatible, is their culture, which means the sum total of the way they dress, the type of expectations in life, of career, the type of interactions and so on, the acceptance of an outsider. Will I fit in? Can I fit in with this group? And it's important, and this is something that your Rebbeim need to help you, because if you come to a place where it's not, it's you're sort of stuck. You're doing what everybody else is doing. You want to do what's right. But you don't feel that, you feel there's so many pieces that just don't fit into place. And just being, first thing is just be aware that it's like that. And then be aware of the different communities, and you need to, sometimes maybe to test it for a while, to live there for a month or two, when you're working as a single person or whatever, and ask yourself, do I see myself integrating with these people? The mores and the clothing and the mannerisms should come automatic. If you're compatible with them and who they are and what they are is compatible, then culturally you're going to fit in. If not, you're always stuck like a sore thumb, and it's a problem, because all of these things are what day-to-day life is about. If you feel uncomfortable dressing the way they dress, or they feel uncomfortable with you dressing the way you dress, if you feel uncomfortable with the schooling that they give their children, and so on, you just there's always going to be a barrier. There's going to be discomfort, and you have to pay attention to that.
How do you define a Ben Torah, especially as about tshuva? What should be one's goal? What does the Jewish community really need from guys like us?
Do I advertise my book at this point? Do I step out of it? No, I wrote something about the transition from kol. So it's not only from Baal Teshuva Yeshiva to life that's difficult, even from a kolo. A Ben Torah, in the sense that I used it, and I think sense of mean, is that I'm still living my Judaism. It's internally very meaningful to me. You have many people who are observant, in a sense. I believe God said you have to do it. I believe there's serious consequences for not doing it. I believe that I'm obligated to doing it, so I'm doing it. It's technically appropriate, but it's a lifeless, because I never feel any connection, not through my learning, not through my davening, not through keeping the mitzvahs, not from my style of life. Drawing from Torah, in its broad sense of the word, means that I'm living it. Torah to me is something living, and that's the way I want to do the things I do. So it is something it's easier in a yeshiva. Obviously, the environment is very conducive for it. It's easy in a city like Yerushalayim, where you have a city that's a yeshiva in a certain sense, even though there's plenty of other places around, but you have a yeshiva. It's much more difficult when you go to a place where you're working in Manhattan all day long. It's a challenge, and yeshivas struggle with it as much as you struggle with it.
When a Torah observant Jew is struggling, for example, like a Baal Teshuva, struggling with his davening, lacking any connection or feeling, so what exactly is the point of davening? Why do you need these fixed rules, and why do you have to daven all the time?
So I would say the following. You know, there are certain things, there are certain skills, let's call them skills. In other words, if a person wants to walk 10 miles to see somebody or something, if he's not used to walk 10 miles, there's no way he can do it. If a person would like, sometime in his life, he decides he wants to play music. If he hasn't learned basics and his fingers are not used to playing it, you can't just pick up a guitar and play it. You need to develop skills that are that take a lot of practice. It may not be rewarding when you're in the practice stage, but when you want to do it, you can do it, and then you have that tool. The davening and being able to say the words, to know what they mean, to do it the way the Torah wants you to do it, the halachas of davening, is a tool. It's an incredible tool. But many people, and again, this includes people born religious, struggle with it. But if you don't have the tool, even when you want to express yourself in the right way, you're not going to have the words, you're not going to have the format that's appropriate. So you're gaining a certain, all the skills to do what you're supposed to do, and then you now are able to try to connect with it. These are all skills, it's just like learning. If you have the skills, the Hebrew, the translation, etc., now you have a choice, learning or not learning. Until you don't have those skills, you don't have that choice. And that's why it's so important.
How do we know when God is testing us versus punishing us?
So the answer is we don't. Unless we have a prophet around, we don't. As a general rule, if a person should feel that he's being tested, because that gives him a reason to do what's right. My first question should be, am I doing things that are wrong? Do I have a sense that what's going wrong is because I'm doing something wrong? If I don't have a sense like that, then I probably need to understand that it's a challenge. And you know, it's something that it's helpful to have somebody with you in this. Because sometimes if people that are extremely obsessive personalities, and all day long they're wondering, you know, was there no coffee this morning in Spanish? Is that a message from God to me? And so on. You can really drive yourself crazy with that. And you need somebody to tell you, you know, you need to chill out. That's what you need to do. And some other people say, you know, you keep on coming back to it again and again. You see it's not working. Don't you feel maybe you should let go? Maybe this is not right. You know, these are things that it's helpful that somebody else helps you navigate it a bit, because we have our own inclinations. Some people want something so much, and even if they see, they keep banging their heads in the wall, they keep pushing for it. And some people, the other way around, they're so obsessive that everything is always, you know, what's the sign and what I'm being told, you spin yourself into helpless circles. So having somebody guiding you who tells you, you know, I think you're overdoing it, or I think you're obtuse. You're not sensitive enough to certain things.
We're often told it's best to move back to the U.S. after yeshiva for optimal impact opportunity and cultural familiarity, which will ease our transitions into frum life. With those benefits, it seems that America is on the decline in terms of morality, culture, and perhaps even safety for Jews. Honestly speaking, where do you see the future of American Yiddishkeit? Is it worth attempting to breathe life back into it?
I think it is alive, actually. I don't think breathing life into it is, I mean, it's alive and kicking and well, Baruch Hashem. I don't think anyone knows. To ask yourself, where should I live, based on what I think the future, I don't know. The future of Klal Yisrael is not just role. Is it now, 10 years from now, 100 years from now? I don't know. And I don't think anyone knows. The decision about where to live should be made. America's a safe country. For instance, people in South Africa, I wonder. South Africa looks, rationally, it looks like it's teetering at the edge of a cliff. And you know, someone actually spoke to me about this, actually. He's thinking of moving, and I understand it. America, there's nothing guaranteed. But Baruch Hashem, as it stands now, it's a reasonable place to live. There's a lot of flourishing Yiddishkeit there. A lot of, not only in Silver Spring, even in places like New York and Lakewood, there's a lot of Yiddish growth over there. So it's and culturally, most everybody here will probably find themselves fitting in a lot easier there. So finding a good community, a strong community that you're comfortable in, I think is the first priority. And building a family in Bez Hashem, if you're Zocha and children make it through yeshivas to Eretz Yisrael, and they're the ones who feel very comfortable living here, they feel it's their place, Ashreichem, you're fortunate. But I'm saying a decision like this should be based on a much shorter vision. No one can predict that type of future. I don't know, you know, who knows? It's something that is, unknown.
We have a premise that God is an infinitely good force who built us out of his own chesed. How do we know that? Is that just a premise? Do we define good simply by observing what Hashem does? Or is there a role for our understanding and intuition in defining and recognizing what is good?
So I would say part of it is because the Torah says what good is. But I think deeper than that, the fact that Hashem gave us existence gratis. You can't get more gratis than this. HaKadosh Baruch Hu owed nothing to anything to anyone, and we became. And nobody would like to cancel existence. Nobody who's not severely depressed would cancel his existence. So the greatest good that I have is myself and my existence. So from my perspective, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is all tov. And then I need to understand that my continued existence and the things that happen to me and the way my life unfolds must be part of a bigger pattern of tov. So we know it from what the Torah says, Olam Chesed Yibaneh, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Tova Meitiv, and so on. But also there's a certain element of logic that flows from the fact that we have existence. There's a mashal, old mashal. I don't remember how it starts. I know the point. There was a doctor came to Paris and said that he can heal people who are blind and deaf. And, you know, he's got the right surgery fit and he does it. So, but his price is very, very, very high. Okay, listen, but, you know, people, So he operates on a blind man, and sure enough he sees, and on a deaf man, and he hears. And they're amazed. The bill comes in the mail 2 weeks later. They're not paying. So he gets in touch with them, and he says, I don't understand something. He calls the blind man and says, I did the operation yesterday. Was successful? Yes. I mean, there's a fee for it. He says, no, I just found out, once I was able to see, I just saw what my wife looks like. And my gosh, I'm not happy at all. So I don't think I owe you anything. The deaf man said, I just discovered what kind of temperament my wife has and what she says. And I'm not happy at all. So he said, okay, no problem. I will undo the operation. I'll make you blind again and you deaf again. He said, no, thank you. He said, okay, so you owe me the bill. He said, you know, we can complain about life. Nobody, and again, unless we identify it as something wrong, a normal person wants to slug through life because he wants to live and wants to exist. So that gratitude is in place. We assume, therefore, that our continued existence with all of its different challenges is part of some greater good in line with that type of good of existence.
What is the role of secular knowledge in a Ben Torah's life? In other words, is it a worthwhile endeavor to learn about biology, math, etc., and what's the limit? What about classical English texts?
I'm
looking at the two Englishmen.
To Englishmen, I thought the literature majors or something, or the
classics majors.
I wouldn't put everything into one basket. So first, let me preface: I don't think there's a broad agreement on this. I think there has been disagreements in the Torah world. The first thing is to understand from a Torah perspective. Hashem's Tov, right and wrong Torah is the core of what Hashem wanted, and the world is a manifestation of it. So therefore, it's just like math, a formula is sort of a description of something at its core, and the graph, how it goes in different circumstances, is a more graphic embodiment of that, and the actual events that are happening are still a more fleshed out version. That's sort of our understanding of from the abstract to the concrete, from Torah to the world. So understanding the world and how it's made and how Kadosh Baruch Hu made it and what all the pieces and parts are has value in terms of understanding the picture of Torah. When Torah speaks about different animals, the Torah speaks about different creations. So one important part is that. It becomes, and it's on a practical level, people have chachmas, wisdom of sorts, adds to a person, and there has been differences of opinion of how much, if at all, given a choice, should a person stick only to Torah knowledge and what he needs for his particular trade, or is a broader soup of knowledge helps you get a bigger picture. It becomes a little more nuanced when it comes to what we call philosophy. Philosophy, I would say, is ideas, understandings. Philosophy includes texts of philosophy. It includes literature in as much as the literature is expressing an idea, a feeling, something abstract. Literature includes in itself two elements. It includes itself a expression of an idea. A good work of literature is expressing some values in a very strong way, in a way that you can that will inspire you. And it's also a form of art, which is it's being able to use words and scenes in a certain way to impress you. So the second part, the art part of it, is technical. And it's a type of skill, and which, again, has value, because learning how to write well and so on helps you express yourself and bring ideas out and so on. The world of ideas becomes challenging because ideas are either the columns and the pillars of truth, or they're substitutes for truth. Philosophies that I disagree with, that I think are wrong, are misleading ideas. Other ideas are truth. How do I know the difference? How do I pick? So there were different, the Rambam felt that Aristotle had the right, what's the right way of saying it? He had the right set of equations. He wasn't always right with his equation, but he had the problem well. And therefore, he took his philosophy as being crucial to knowledge, with rejecting outright some of it. But even rejecting certain points, he still felt that he had the right building blocks, and using his building blocks are very important. There are other philosophers. The Rama writes to somebody what to look, and he said the other. He writes about certain other things that they're not worth looking at. It's a waste of time and it's rubbish. Can we do the same? Can we have that ability to take the ideas and say, "Wow, the formulation of that idea helps you understand many truths of Torah," and how time and how much and how long and how much of it would be misleading? You know, I obviously would be reluctant that a person would invest his life in it, because it takes a long time for you to understand an idea, to sort of be on top of it, and to be able to make a real critical decision, emes, not emes. So in the world of facts, like sciences, there is value. And different opinions on how much of it and so on. The Rishonim all seem to be well acquainted with the sciences of their days, and they didn't see any issue with it. The world of ideas and philosophy is much trickier, because sometimes it's a tool for truth, because the way a person formulates an idea, you're able to use it, and many times it's misleading. So generally speaking, most Chachmei Yisrael have been wary of telling people that it's smart to sort of be steeped in the world of ideas.
What is the main responsibility of the Jewish community in the world today?
To be Jewish. I'm serious. It's you know, yeshiva is a part of a life. It's the most inspiring part. It's living Judaism at its most powerful and total manifestation. A community needs to help give an environment that will allow for that to happen. We're hampered. There's a lot of issues. Communities are not set in stone. So sometimes you have a shul, which tends to be our community, and you have a dozen people are upset. They break away and they make their own shul. And then some other people get upset with that, and the others. We struggle. But understanding that the purpose of a community is to create the environment that will foster living like a Torah, living fully, you know, inspired, connected, and vibrant.
Is archaeology a reliable source to use for enhancing emunah?
So I'll just have a few more minutes. I don't know what time we have to go.
One more question.
Okay.
Is archaeology a reliable source to use for enhancing emunah in the stories specifically told in the Chumash and early Tanakh? And if it is, what evidence do you find compelling?
So, let's go slowly. The advantage of archaeology is that you have actual pieces. It's very, very powerful when you actually have a piece in your hand. The problem with archaeology is it's never a story. Let's give an example. Imagine there's a whodunit. Somebody did some crime, and we have the good old Sherlock Holmes comes in with his hat and big magnifying glass, and he looks for clues and stuff like that. Now, and he comes up with some sort of picture that the guy who broke in this jewelry store is from a mob in Tanzania that have a secret code, and that's why they found the cucumber peel over here, and this, that, the whole thing, and everybody's just amazed. Unfortunately, it's 100 years later, and there's a video camera there. Video camera is a very different story. So we will reluctantly say, you know, those pieces, I still don't know why there's a cucumber peel here, and I don't know why there's a thread over there, but I've got a movie here, and that's a story. But I do like to have, you know, sometimes you want to have the two together. It brings home the message much more powerfully, especially when you don't have the video cameras reliable. It's not so clear, and you see it. So the history we have, the reliable history we have, is a video camera. It's information, it's a story, it's testimony. The bits and pieces of archaeologists tries to make a story out of it. You ever play a game, they'll give everybody like these weird objects or weird pictures and say, tell me a story about this. So sometimes very creative. And sometimes you're taking some things for granted. You'll find the little Avodah Zarah in Jerusalem, dated to whatever. You say, oh, the Jews were into worship Avodah Zarah because we found already two or three Avodah Zarah. Maybe there was a colony of Avodah Zarah there. I don't know. You know, so I like it for its impact. And the fact that we actually, Dead Sea Scrolls, you have something here that is almost exactly like everything we have in Kisvei HaKodesh, with errors of the typical type you would have, minor errors of typical type you have anytime you transcribe. So that tells me we've faithfully reproduced. Isaiah was considered by the scholars for the longest of times to be two separate works that in a very late stage were merged together because of the predictions about Koresh and so on. Well, guess what? They found Yeshaya in the entire Second Temple was one safer. So to which the answer was, wow, the mistake was so long ago. Okay, you know, that's when you put a story ahead of. But when you see it, it's very, very powerful. And it has, we'll finish with this, just this, something that happened to me. I was in Budapest this summer. And they have on the Danube, they have what's called Shoes on the Danube. And the Danube River in 44 or so, they marched out thousands of Jews, tied hands together, threw them into the freezing river and killed them. We know the story. Everybody knows the story. They made a memorial to it. A lot of shoes laid out. They're sort of gilded, so you know they don't. But shoes, baby shoes, adult shoes, women's shoes, and the place. Its impact is extraordinarily powerful. And I asked myself why. I know the story, and if the story is not true, anybody could have laid out those shoes. But having some piece over there is extremely powerful. And that's one of the reasons why our commemorations of Yontif are not speeches. It's a piece of matzah. And I take a piece of matzah and I say, we don't even... The atheist admits that it's been 2,000 years that this same piece of matzah has been broken by families and eaten. The record is... It goes back to it. It's very powerful. It's this is it. Holach ma'anya, this sukkah. These are things. Objects have a very powerful effect. So when we're sure the story and we know for sure when we have the correct video and we can put in the pieces, I think that adds a lot. We haven't done enough in it. I don't think, you know, we've always been wary of it because the archaeologists constructed a different story. They're coming with a mindset of what society should look like, what they think it should look like, and they transpose it. But if we have the right thing, and hopefully somebody will pick up the challenge and make a museum of artifacts that help us get the those shoes on the Danube of Yiddishkeit, I think it would be a powerful addition for things. Okay, I'm sorry, I have to go, but...
thank you, Rabbi.
That's it. Okay, good.